KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Microsoft plans to announce a major reorganization this week. Coming up on weekday, we're going to hear more about it from Puget Sound Business Journal Managing Editor Michelle Matassa Flores. The weekend explosion of that Canadian oil train has a lot of people thinking about the best way to move oil from point A to point B. Some oil industry execs in Canada say with the lack of pipelines, trains are the best transportation method. And Vaughn Palmer joins us once again to talk about this and other news from Canada. And Vaughn, we've been hearing little snippets about the investigation, but if you could remind us what happened over the weekend.
Yeah, this is a horrific accident, Marcy. The police in the province of Quebec in that little tourist town, Lac-Megantic, 60 people dead or missing. They've had to ask local residents who have relatives missing who haven't been located yet to donate DNA samples because the destruction in the center of town is such that they're very concerned that some of the missing were simply vaporized in the explosion. What you had happen was a train that was stopped outside of town, and the preliminary indications are this is what happened. Someone spots a fire on the train. The fire department attends. They put the fire out. They leave the train, and sometime after that, in the early morning hours of Saturday, the train starts moving. It rolls downhill about 4 or 5 miles into the center of town where it derails and explodes. It is loaded with oil. It's a terrifying accident. Obviously, the community is shattered. The town is destroyed. There'll be a long investigation. The provincial police in the province of Quebec are giving indications today that criminal charges may well be laid here. Obviously, with something like this, there's a certain amount of finger-pointing goes on as well.
Vaughn, what kinds of regulations exist for trains that do carry oil or any other volatile substance?
Well, you know, this one is a microcosm of what has been happening in the rail industry and the oil industry in North America. The oil on this train originated at the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. That is, as you well know, a major oil development that's come along in the United States in the last few years. It's in a region of the continent that is not served all that extensively by pipelines, so a lot of the oil that is coming out of that region is moved by rail. There's been an enormous shift to rail transport of oil in the last few years because of opposition to pipelines, because of new developments in places like North Dakota where there aren't a lot of pipelines. So the oil moves out of the United States across Canada. It is destined, the train that had that load of oil that exploded on Saturday morning, was destined for St. John, New Brunswick, where there's a refinery, and had the oil made it there, the oil from there is refined and normally sold back into the American market. So what we have here is a reminder, too, of just how integrated the oil trade is in North America and how the oil finds its way to market even if you manage to block one pipeline.
Has anybody for Canadian National Railroad talked about what kind of train this particular accident involved?
And obviously, as I said, this is a small independent railway runs out of Canada across Maine and back into Canada again. There's a railway right away Canadian railway right away that goes through they call it the cutoff in the state of Maine. If you look at a map, you can see where it is. There's a running controversy in this country and in the United States as well over the safety of rail transport. If you want to build an oil pipeline, as we well know, you have to get a permit, you have to have our environmental hearings. But basically, a railway can just hitch up a bunch of cars, load up with oil, and haul them pretty much anywhere in North America. There's a concern over the safety of rail cars. There have been repeated complaints in Canada and the United States that oil transport cars of the old kind, and these appear to be old cars, the walls are not very thick, They crumple on impact, they explode on impact, and they're not even safe for transporting even light crude oil, which this was, never mind the heavier products that are also being moved. So, you know, it's ironic, I guess, or scary, or whatever you want adjective you want to use, that we're paying massive amounts of attention in both countries to two pipelines, one that would go through BC and the Keystone that would go through the United States. Meanwhile, you know, the rest of the world goes on, and we're moving oil all over the continent by train with minimal regulation, and clearly, in this case, inadequate regulation.
I'm sure that people are still really stung by the immediate tragedy of the explosion, but has what happened over the weekend in Quebec sort of reignited supporters of pipeline construction?
I think the answer, the shock is still there, and the answer from one of the big pipeline companies was there's no winner in this thing. I mean, yes, you can make an argument. I think the argument will be made in future that pipelines are a safer way to transport oil on balance. It's true that pipelines rupture from time to time. It is true that a pipeline rupture can lead to significant environmental pollution if it isn't caught in time. But you compare that to the challenge of transporting oil with by rail, with derailments. It's true that maybe not as much oil spills, but we see here, too, the danger of transporting oil by rail through populated areas. So there's an argument back and forth. As I said, one of the major pipeline companies in Canada today said, look, this is just a tragedy. There's no winners in this. Clearly, we have to think about environmental regulation with everything we do. But I guess the other thing you'd have to say is, as I say, just because you stopped a pipeline doesn't mean you're stopping world consumption of oil or even the way they're moving it. I mean, the only reason we know where this oil came from and where it was going is because obviously an awful lot of attention has been paid to this one train. But this happens every day in North America. The most recent data that I've seen, Marcy, says that oil shipment by rail has tripled just in the past year. It's increased by about 20-fold in the last 5 years.
Well, Vaughn, leaving this tragedy, at least for the time being, another piece of news that's interesting is that the U.S. ambassador to Canada leaves his post very shortly, and there's nobody to fill it.
Yeah, normally in the Canada-U.S. relationship, if the president wins two terms, he rotates his ambassador to Canada. David Jacobson, a prominent Democratic Party fundraiser from Chicago, was the American ambassador to Canada for the first term of the Obama administration. I think this is his last week on the job. Well-liked up here, has been a very popular ambassador, very effective. When the word passed in January that he was obviously leaving and there'd be a new ambassador, there was an immediate buzz. In fact, I talked about it on the show. There were some real superstars, political superstars on the short list. Christine Gregoire at one point, Brian Schweitzer, the retired governor of Montana, Jennifer Granholm of Michigan, who's an American citizen, but she was born in Canada, so a lot of people thought she'd have been a good choice. There's been very little lately. There's been a couple of names rotated around. I think the last one was this some guy from Goldman Sachs, which did not generate a lot of excitement on this side of the border. Bruce Hayman, Obama fundraiser from Chicago. But at the moment, you know, there's no indication of a new ambassador to Canada, although maybe the president is going to surprise us with a name soon. At the moment, it looks like the post is going to be vacant for a bit.
Well, you know, as you talk about political fundraisers, I get the impression that these are political patronage jobs, but it seems that an ambassador would need to have certain diplomatic skills.
Canada... Let me phrase this diplomatically. Canada is regarded as a fairly nice posting for American ambassadors. The two countries deal with each other in relatively civilized ways. Even when we're fighting over softwood lumber or other issues, we get along pretty well. Ambassadors, American ambassadors are well treated up here. They're very polite about Canada. They tend to get along. I mean, one of the biggest scandals with an American ambassador to Canada in my lifetime was Reagan sent somebody up here who fired the French chef at the American Embassy in Ottawa, and he immediately went out and opened one of the top French restaurants in Ottawa. So that was kind of, because the guy couldn't do barbecue or something. But, you know, that's the kind of controversy you get up here. I mean, in general, the relationship is very, very good. The worst appointment probably the other way was when Canada's ambassador to the States, who happened to be the Prime Minister's nephew, it made an ill-advised statement just before the election where Bush beat Gore that Canada probably would have preferred Gore, mm-hmm. which we've seen again is not very diplomatic. Generally we get along. I think that's why you don't... The best diplomats in the State Department tend to be reserved for the really tough assignments, Middle East and that sort of thing. And fundraisers who want an ambassadorship, you bet. If they can get Paris, they'll take Paris. But some of the nicer ones will take Ottawa as a consolation prize, and I guess that's what's going on at the moment.
Are you guys thinking that you want to add New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to the list of maybes now?
Hey, the fight over the Peace Bridge is settled. So the bridge between Fort Erie, Canada, and Buffalo, New York, I guess is roughly where it is. Anyway, it's called the Peace Bridge. And ironically, it has been the subject of a pretty nasty fight between the governor of New York and the Canadian authorities who jointly administer the bridge. The Buffalo and Fort Erie Public Bridge Authority was looking at an American plan to expand access and safety and public space on the American side, but because the bridge is jointly administered, they need the agreement of the Canadian authorities, who were dragging their feet because they thought the Americans were paying too much. That led to a noisy public spat. A passing of a piece of legislation in the New York State Legislature to abolish the authority, a threat from the Cuomo administration to act unilaterally. And in fact, one of David Jacobson's last jobs as the U.S. ambassador to Canada was to kind of sort this thing out. He and Gary Doerr, the Canadian ambassador to the U.S., brought a peace agreement between the two countries over what is surely one of the sillier eruptions in Canada-U.S. relationship over the last few years. I mean, no one even saw the irony of arguing over the peace bridge.
Well, I do have to say that points out that we do really need an ambassador between our one on each side of the border.
Yeah, I mean, this thing could have gotten out of hand. We could have, you know, been handing out parking tickets to each other or you know, sending each other's parking lot attendants after each other if we hadn't sorted this out.
And just quickly to finish, Yvonne, the couple that we talked about last week, the BC bomb plotters, they went before a judge this week?
They went before a judge yesterday in provincial court in Surrey where they live. The case was elevated to BC Supreme Court. They're going to try to proceed against them by direct indictment. So that appearance is in court today in Vancouver. We may get a little more detail today, although in general when people are before the courts in Canada, the authorities release very little. There's often a fairly severe ban on publication, a little like the grand jury system in the United States.
Well, we'll hope to have more details when we talk with you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Thanks.
Bye-bye, Marcy.
Thanks, Vaughn. Vaughn Palmer writes for the Vancouver Sun, and he's with us every Wednesday on Weekday on KUOW.
It's 10:20. Good morning. I'm Guy Nelson. Everett Herald film critic Robert Horton reviews what's happening on the silver screen in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Zoo Tunes, presenting John Hyatt with Holly Williams on July 17th, Randy Newman on July 24th, and Leanne Rimes on July 26th. Tickets, complete show calendar, and more at zoo.org/zootunes.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's evening tour is Thursday, July 18th at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours@kuow.org.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. The movies of 1963 mark their 50th anniversary this year. Film critic Robert Horton joins us with a look back at the movies that made their mark back then. Robert Horton is a film critic, longtime contributor to KOW. You can find his reviews at the Everett Herald and at his blog, The Crop Duster. He also is the curator of Celluloid Seattle at the Museum of History and Industry. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Katie.
Hello. So was 1963 a particularly good year for films?
You know, it's funny because in my estimation, and I've gone through many, many years and made top 10 lists and put them on my blog, and 1963 is not a great year for movies. Like 1962, fantastic year. 1963, I don't know. That there's kind of a falling off there.
What made 1962 so good?
I'm not sure, but it's just turned out a lot of movies that I really, really like are out that year. I think my number one that year was Jules and Jim, and there's just like a whole bunch of really good ones.
Well, how do you go about compiling a top 10 list?
Oh, it's just, you know.
Do you first Google movies of 1963
yeah,
and see what pops up?
Yeah, you could do that and like take your picks. Or if you're like me, you've just kind of written things down for many years, like a slightly obsessive person might do, and have some sort of urge to rank them. And so obviously I do. And once I get my kind of basic list, then I'll go to, the Internet Movie Database and see what I've forgotten and then figure out that really was released in 1963 or whatever. And then you start to just think, well, what would be at the top? What's kind of middle and what would be my little dark horse pick? You know, like what are my special little films that aren't great maybe, but I just really like them.
So that, what are you weighing to decide who ends up on number one at number one?
Oh, man.
That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you compare? Movies are very different from each other.
And it's kind of absurd, too, because the movies do different things. So in the year of in the case of 1963, it kind of came down to like, what somehow sums it up? I didn't have a clear cut one. So what was just like a movie that seemed to say a lot and that seemed to shoot really high and try a lot of things, and it somehow is about maybe where people were at that time. And the one I came up with was 8.5. Certainly a celebrated title in the annals of foreign film, kind of a high point for Federico Fellini, who was a famous film director in an era when a foreign director might be on the cover of Time magazine, which is kind of unthinkable now, that somebody like Fellini, who just made these weird, very imaginative films, would be so familiar to the culture. But it was true. And he had this great success a couple of years earlier with La Dolce Vita, film that was a smash hit. You know, despite being a long Italian film, it was huge in America, partly, I think, because it had kind of racy content, which really helped a lot of foreign films back then because they could do things that Hollywood movies didn't. But everybody loved that. And 8.5 is the film that followed that, where with the world at his feet, he could do whatever he wanted. And it suggests some ambivalence about that because, of course, it's a film about a film director who can't decide what his next project is going to be.
Right.
Marcello Mastroianni playing the role.
And filmed sort of surrealist and black and white.
Yeah, beautiful, gorgeous black and white. And with, yes, I would say some touches that do not feel like realism. But then that was never really Fellini's concern, was to be totally in the real world.
Why is it that a foreign films in 1963 would have been hotter than, say, they are today?
Yeah, it's funny. That was the great era of meeting these directors like Ingmar Bergman and Fellini and the French New Wave guys like François Truffaut. And maybe it was just that there were fewer famous foreign film directors, and so the cream rose to the top, and people were excited about it. And maybe it was it seemed like something new was going on, which it was in some of their films. They were really groundbreaking. And I also think just the fact that foreign films could address things that the motion picture code would not allow Hollywood films to do. So even not just the fact that there might be a little bit of the SEX quality in them, which Hollywood wouldn't even spell out, but that they just talked about adult things, you know, adult subjects and interesting, unusual things, catching the vibe of the moment, certain kind of uncertainty maybe going on in the culture that Hollywood was not getting to. So it was a kind of a great era for that. And so somehow 8.5 gathers all that together and epitomizes it. And even though I am actually not the world's biggest Fellini fan, I don't love him in the way that I love some of the works of some of the other filmmakers of that era. But boy, 8.5, if you got to pick a number one for 1963, I think that might be it.
And you got a lot of foreign films on this list.
I did for this year, yeah.
Can you contrast, I don't know if this is even possible, but number three is The Birds by Alfred Hitchcock, and yep. Number four you have America, America. Maybe as a way of illustration, how different are those movies from each other, one being American and one being foreign?
Boy, they are different. America, America is one of the lesser known films on my list, and it's a film that's actually made by an American filmmaker, Elia Kazan, who had been, you know, won Oscars for Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront, and was a successful filmmaker. But he, with that film, he almost got into the foreign filmmaking business because he made a big movie about his family history, shot partly in Greece and about a young Greek kid trying to make his way out of Europe and gets to America at the very, very end. And so it was almost like watching a Hollywood filmmaker who wanted to be a little more like all those exciting, you know, foreign film directors that were going on. And just a very engaging film. No stars in it, but a really quite a saga. The Birds, of course, comes from one of the most established of all Hollywood filmmakers, Alfred Hitchcock. And that one's interesting to me because the last time I saw The Birds, it really struck me that Hitchcock must have been watching some of those foreign films like Antonioni and Bergman, because if you watch The Birds, of course it's a horror movie about birds attacking people, but it's also kind of it's a little arty for Hitchcock. He actually is kind of getting into some of those. It's in many ways it's a very bleak film, and if people remember the ending, I won't give it away, but it ends on a suspended note rather than we're going to wrap this up, take care of the whatever the birds are doing, and everything's going to be fine. It doesn't end like that, and it's kind of haunting because of that.
I like this movie I'd never heard of that you have at number five. Not a great title, The Shock Corridor.
Shock Corridor.
Not a great trailer, either.
I'm sure the trailer must be a little sensationalistic, I'll bet.
You should check it out. Here, let me play a little example.
The motion picture screen opens the door to sights you've never seen before. Shock Corridor. The medical jungle doctors don't talk about. Case history number one. Johnny B., brilliant newspaper reporter, suffering from hallucinations that his sweetheart is his sister. Diagnosis, erotic dementia. Case history number two. Kathy B., stripteaser, young, intelligent, beautiful. Kathy's torrid performances, however, reveal her avid reaction to the excitement of male audiences. Diagnosis? Manic sensualist.
Hmm. Manic sensualist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think I like the sound of that. Shock Corridor is a film that you must see. It is a B-movie, very much so. It was made by a writer-director Samuel Fuller, who worked largely in that zone of low-budget films. And it's just got a great concept, which is it is about a journalist who goes into a psychiatric hospital to do a story, and what he uncovers there is just like this incredible array of stuff going on that is really interesting and wild, and in some strange way seems to be about what's going on in America at the time, which is really cool because it is on the other hand just a B movie that's sort of an exploitation film, but It seems to engage with all these interesting ideas, and it goes all the way. It is quite an uncompromising film in its own way, and has got some great moments that definitely justify the title, Shock Corridor. There are a few definite shocks in here.
Yeah, this is the one on the list in looking at clips of all of them that I was thinking that maybe I would look up.
I think you should. I strongly recommend it.
Number six, The Nutty Professor, not the Eddie Murphy movie from 1996, of course, but Jerry Lewis's movie.
Yeah.
That also has a very strange trailer. Let's take a listen.
Okay.
We don't care if you blab about the beginning of this picture, nor do we care if you give away the ending, but we do care if you reveal the middle. In In fact, Jerry Lewis urges you to see this picture from the beginning on penalty of losing your popcorn privileges. One thing we will tell you is that Jerry plays the part of an eccentric chemistry professor who invents the greatest new drink since Dracula discovered the Bloody Mary. One sip and he turns into... Ah, that would be telling. And even those who know aren't telling.
Are you telling? Huh. What does he turn into, Robert?
I didn't realize that that was a gimmick for the promotion of the film.
Yes, that's how it's advertised.
Well, mild-mannered Professor Julius Kelp does make up this potion, and he turns into a kind of a lounge lizard swinger type by the name of Buddy Love. So it's a complete Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of role reversal, and Jerry Lewis plays that to the hilt, and it's a lot of people have thought that in some ways this character, this kind of sleazy operator, Buddy Love, is like Jerry Lewis's version of Dean Martin, his old comedy partner. Although it also seems just kind of like Jerry Lewis when he's not playing Jerry Lewis, when he's, you know, on the telethon or whatever. He's got the... It's a pretty interesting movie. But it's very funny, and a lot of people think it's maybe Jerry Lewis's high point as actor, writer, director, producer, which he was back then. He was on an incredible streak where he was really a box office king for quite a few years. And Nutty Professor is probably his best sustained moment, I would say.
Well, in writing about it on your blog, you say, "The Nutty Professor gives the world Buddy Love. Charade shows you how it's done right." Charade, of course, is at number 8. What do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? I'm not sure what I meant by that. That sounds strange.
Would it help you if I played a little clip from Charade?
Oh, let's hear that.
Do we know each other?
Why do you think we're going to?
I don't know. How would I know?
Because I already know an awful lot of people, and until one of them dies, I couldn't possibly meet anyone else.
Well, if anyone goes on the critical list, let me know.
No. Of course, that's Cary Grant.
Yes.
Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, unmistakably.
I've never actually seen this movie.
Oh, well, you have to see it. It is a delightful film. It is sort of a pseudo-Hitchcock kind of idea, directed by Stanley Donen, and just some mistaken identity and plots going on, and Cary Grant thrown together, mostly in Paris, with Audrey Hepburn. And it's one of those great films where there's a plot going on, but... And it'll get worked out in a satisfactory way, but what really matters is other stuff, like snappy dialogue and how good Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant look and how they move around each other and the sort of banter that they have. And that is just, like, sublime throughout this film. And it's fun. It's a really fun movie to watch, and it's very, very skillfully done, and it reminds you of how hard it is to do this kind of thing well, to, like, carry off this thing that seems sort of lighter than air. But it's tricky to do. They tried to remake it a few years ago, you know, with perfectly good people involved, and it did not. It just absolutely leaden did not work at all. You gotta know how to make the souffle, you know.
Well, how well established was Audrey Hepburn at that time? Cary Grant's older in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, this is 63, as we said. So she was an established star. So she was already a very big. Successful actor, so they would have been, you know, it was one of those things where, I mean, did Cary Grant's age ever really matter? If you were, you know, Audrey Hepburn, I'm sure he must have had.
He's like George Clooney.
25 years on her, yeah, but that did not seem to matter, especially at this like the level of here are these two sort of shimmering stars. This is the one where there's some great dialogue in it that almost seems to comment on Cary Grant rather than his character, whatever he's playing. This is the one where she says to him, you know what the matter with you is? And he says, what? And she says, nothing. And that's sort of Cary Grant.
Yeah.
I think audiences would have shared that sentiment.
Well, he does the same line, too. I believe there's some similar line that he does where he says... he's staring at her, and he says, "I'm looking at your face." And she says, "Well, what's wrong with it?" And he says, "Nothing."
Hmm. Yes.
So, At least that's what I remember. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's accurate. That was from a clip I saw. I still need to actually see this entire movie.
That's right.
Well, before we're out of time, let's do the final one on the list.
Okay.
Number 10. The one that, is this the dark horse, the one that eked onto the list?
Well, tell me what it is.
The Servant.
Oh, The Servant. Yeah, The Servant is a classic British film written by Harold Pinter, directed by Joseph Losey, that is just one of the all-time power play movies and just a real puts you through the grinder as you watch a somewhat pampered gentleman in London and his manservant, played by Dirk Bogarde. And you start to watch the ways that one gets the upper hand on the other one, and it's not the one that you think it's going to be. It's very sinister, creepy kind of movie.
What are they trying to accomplish? What are they getting the upper hand about?
Oh, what people are always trying to get the upper hand about, which is just sheer control over whatever the situation is. And Dirk Bogarde's character is so so utterly needful of that he kind of manages to exert it over this guy's life.
And who is the servant?
The servant is Bogarde, and his gentleman is James Fox.
Okay.
Yeah, who later had sustained a good career. I think my dark horse, which did not make my top 10 list, but I had it in my also-rans that I would mention, is Jason and the Argonauts.
Mm.
Classic fantasy film, special effects by Ray Harryhausen, a legendary figure in special effects who just died a few weeks ago. This is a movie where it's about, Greek legends and all that. And this is a movie where toward the end, a group of skeletons rise from the ground because they've been summoned, and they do battle with our heroes. And the skeletons, this army of skeletons, is entirely stop-motion animation. So the sort of painstaking effort that they put into doing this is mind-blowing. And anybody who ever saw this movie when they were a little kid, as I did, will never, ever forget that.
From Night Terror?
I may have woken me up occasionally, but mostly I think just the awesome coolness of it is what lingers.
Did you experiment with making films when you were a kid?
No, I never had. I never had like a Super 8 camera in our family or anything like that. So I was not one of those kids who tried to do the stop motion animation thing and take one frame and move the thing a little bit. No. I made monster models. That was about the extent of it.
It's never too late.
True.
You can do it now.
True. Okay.
The top 10 movies of 1963 with Robert Horton. Robert is a film critic and longtime contributor to KYW. You can also find his reviews in the Everett Herald and at his blog, The Crop Duster. He's also a curator of Celluloid Seattle at the Museum of History and Industry. And you're on Twitter now. Follow him at Citizen Horton on Twitter.
That's what they tell me.
I know. I'm going to have to follow you.
You got
to
get on there.
Citizen Horton on Twitter. Once I figure out how to use Twitter.
Ah, well, don't worry about that.
Thanks so much, Robert.
Thanks, Katie.
This is Weekday.
KUOW Seattle. Good morning. I'm Guy Nelson. It's 10:39. Puget Sound Business Journal managing editor Michelle Matassaflores wraps up the region's economic news in a minute.
The KUOW Puget Sound Public Radio Board meets every other month. Meetings are open to the public. Please visit our website at kuow.org for more information.
It's 59 degrees in Seattle's University District on our way to a sunny afternoon after the morning clouds burn off. High of 75 today. It'll be cloudy overnight with a low of 57, and Thursday and Friday partly sunny with highs in the low 70s.
Support for KUOW comes from Fuller Theological Seminary Northwest, offering master's degrees in theology and divinity at its Seattle campus, multi-denominational with on-site and online class schedules to fit busy lives. Currently accepting applications. Information at fuller.edu/northwest.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Investigators are continuing to look into the cause of the crash of the Asiana Airlines 777 on Saturday. New evidence indicates that there might have been a mechanical problem with the automatic throttles. Michelle Matassaflores is managing editor at the Puget Sound Business Journal. She joins me now. Hello, nice to see you again.
Hi, Marcy.
Well, turn on your mic and then it'll be good to hear from you. Try it now.
Hi, Marcy.
Ah, very good. There you are. She's really here. So yesterday, the National Transportation Safety Board Chair, Deborah Hersman, briefed reporters, and even though she warned them not to speculate on causes, she did say that there might have been something wrong with this automatic throttle.
Yes, they had finally interviewed, I think, two of the four cabin crew or cockpit crew on the plane, and it came up that they thought the auto throttle was set for the standard landing speed, which I guess is 137 knots, something I learned over the weekend.
Yes.
Which suggests that maybe it was set and failed somehow, although it's also possible that they thought they had set it and hadn't.
Because this was a pilot in training,
exactly.
Landing this plane. I was curious, if it indeed was a mechanical problem, what would that mean for the Boeing company, which is sort of surrounded by problems right now?
Right. They just, you know, barely have come out of the problems they had with the 787 and the battery issues. The exact steps, you know, I couldn't recite them, but usually what'll happen is there'll be a directive to look beyond that one plane, you know, and check out an entire fleet. And this is a fleet of, what, 1,100, I think, planes that are out there.
So the 787s, the battery problems resulted in grounding a fleet, not just sending out a...
Right, and in that case, it was only six jets, because that's such a new plane.
Wow. So it could be widespread, but they... As I understand it, Deborah Hersman mentioned that they were going to do another press briefing today.
Right. That's the last I heard. I hadn't heard a time yet.
So we're just sort of waiting at this point.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that there's always an emphasis on not jumping to conclusions, and yet every time we jump to conclusions again, we being the public, the media, everybody, it's human nature, I think, to reach for a cause. And she seemed to be going to great lengths all weekend to urge people not to do that. And yet even the head of the airline, this I really haven't seen before, the head of Oceana Airline came out over the weekend the first day and said, oh, this plane had no mechanical problems.
I don't know that he'd rather have it be the fault of one of his pilots. That would be
That's what was kind of striking to me about that.
Well, so we will take Deborah Hersman's advice and just sit and wait.
Right.
And your reporters and every other reporter will be waiting for briefings, and see that on your website. Well, let's move from Boeing to one of our other area main employers, which is Microsoft. Tomorrow, as I understand it, this long-rumored reorganization is going to be announced.
Well, that is still...
It's still a rumor?
Yeah. You know, Microsoft hasn't come out and said they're doing it tomorrow, but... There have been multiple reports that they are, and some of those, especially All Things D, it looks like they're getting leaks from the company, I think.
From within the company itself?
It feels that way to me. And they've done some great reporting on this, very detailed reporting. And they say it's out tomorrow. We haven't heard that directly from the company, though.
But that's kind of been on the, at least running through the tech rumor mill for a couple of weeks,
right,
at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us back. Why would Microsoft even be considering a major reorg?
Well, first of all, it's important to remember that they do this on occasion. This is, you know.
So this is not like the sky is falling, the sky is falling.
Right. It's not extraordinary at all. In fact, it's a little bit ordinary to me anyway, having watched them for a lot of years. They've gone through this a number of times, and it's often described as in these kind of monumental terms. And yet, I don't know, the changes have felt kind of incremental to me over the years in terms of the effect it actually has on the way the company operates.
Well, one thing that Steve Ballmer, who's essentially running the company now, has said is that he wanted to refocus Microsoft on devices and services. And I'm not sure, maybe you can shed some more light on what that means.
I will try to channel him the best I can.
Okay.
Historically, Microsoft has been software in a box. If you think back, you know, you buy your CD with Windows on it, or a floppy disk going farther back.
Really?
Put it into a computer, fire it up, and load the software. Now, even its kind of bread and butter software like the Office Suite. People are buying that more on a subscription basis and downloading it. The software is actually on a cloud server somewhere, not on your computer, that type of thing. I think that's one piece of it. The other one, maybe even bigger or at least more tangible and for a layperson or a consumer, is the trend toward devices. Microsoft last year came out with its own tablet, the Surface. It's pushing and pushing and pushing its Windows phone.
Yeah.
Like the little train that's trying to get up the hill. So it's heading more in that, you know, touch screen operating system. It's trying to get away from the staid old desktop computer.
We're talking with Michelle Matassa Flores, managing editor of Puget Sound Business Journal, pushing that Windows phone. I haven't looked at sales statistics recently, but they aren't good.
Yeah. To be honest, I quit watching a little while ago, too.
They weren't making a big dent in the market for Android and iPhone.
No, in terms of market share, it wasn't making much of a dent. In terms of just public awareness, it wasn't making much of a dent. And the last thing I saw that was notable was that Nokia was dropping the price, which tells you something.
And what about the Surface? Has that tablet done well?
It's not lighting the world on fire, but it seems to... I haven't heard as much dissing of it as the Windows phone sales anyway, but I think it's a little bit early still to tell.
No, I know that they just... upgraded the upgraded Windows operating system. It's now Windows 8.1,
yes,
which was sort of walking back some of the upgrades that Windows 8 had put in.
Kind of. Point one meant adding back in the start button that everybody apparently missed so much.
So maybe that's going to entice some more customers to a device like the Surface, which does run on the Windows.
Yeah, Microsoft has to walk a tricky line here because so much of their business comes from what's called the enterprise market, which is companies buying the software, the operating system, computers that are running on Windows. And they're not so quick to change. They're not the hipsters walking around with the phones and the tablets.
Well, there was one other big device, the Xbox One, which was unveiled and then revamped. And the guy who was in charge of all this,
Don Mattrick.
Yeah, Don Mattrick. I was going to say jump ship. That's probably not the right way to frame it. But he left to head up Zynga last week.
Right. And, the Microsoft and Zynga and Mattrick seem to all portray that as just taking a great opportunity. And that, who knows, it could be exactly what that is. He had been kind of at the center of that firestorm over some really controversial elements of the Xbox One that had, in particular, alienated the hardcore gaming community, which is what the Xbox had been all about.
So we need to watch both Zynga and the Xbox, which isn't actually even on the market until late fall, as I understand
it. Xbox One.
One,
won't
not
come out
Xbox.
Until just kind of before the holiday sales season.
The one box to do everything. Your reporter, Emily Parkhurst, briefly profiled some of the possible players who would sort of rise like the cream to the top at Microsoft in a reorg. And frankly, if you're not in the Microsoft loop, none of these names are particularly familiar.
They're not they're not celebrity names, no. I think some people may have heard of Tony Bates. He's the Skype guy.
He came with Skype, though,
yes,
right?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
The rest of them are pretty... obscure names.
Skype, the acquisition, cost Microsoft a lot of money. That's actually been a pretty good deal for the company.
Yeah. They've been complimented on that acquisition, finding it, bringing it in, and integrating it the way it's been integrated so far. It's thought to be going pretty well for Microsoft.
So despite the fact that the company's been taking hits in other arenas, it's not like it's totally lost a direction.
Right. And, you have to remember the stock. People are always complaining about the stock price, but and it is lower, quite a bit lower than it was at its peak, which came its absolute peak came way back in the end of 1999. But it's not a penny stock, you know.
you're not investing in junk there.
Yeah.
From the future of Microsoft, which I'm assuming that your staff's going to be watching, and if there is a major reorg announced, you can read it in Puget Sound Business Journal. Seattle area housing market, interesting. we've watched as unemployment rate has fallen to 4%, and now we're seeing that the housing market is just like red hot again.
Mm-hmm.
It's been interesting to see.
Yeah, it's red hot from the standpoint of homes getting multiple offers, a lot of bidding war kind of things going on, and you hear of people getting pre-offer inspections to speed up, you know, their offer process and that type of thing. I think one thing that's holding it back a little bit is a lack of inventory. So it's not red hot, maybe in the way that homes were selling like hotcakes at a couple other peaks in the market, but it is showing real signs of going crazy. And we had a story recently quoting, I think it was the Realtors Association, saying they're desperate for inventory.
Well, I wonder, you know, when we're talking about people pre-qualifying and pre-inspecting and putting out multiple offers, I had thought that after the big housing bust and all the lending practices that came to light, that that lenders were going to be a little more cautious in who they did pre-authorize. Like, everybody's not going to be authorized to get a home loan at this point, are they?
You sure would think that they'd show some restraint. I think that the biggest problem seemed to be qualifying people for more than they could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And approving loans with kind of wacky terms, especially adjustable rate mortgages with big balloon payments at the end, or, you know, after just 5 years, that type of thing. So those practices were supposed to either go away or be reduced greatly. I'm not sure they are.
I'd be curious. I mean, we haven't had much interest in the market because people haven't had really money.
Yeah, I don't think it's been tested yet.
But the other area that we have seen must have loosened up is lending for commercial construction, at least in the Seattle and Bellevue area, because commercial construction is just way up.
That's another one where I often wonder if anybody learns the lessons that they should learn along the way. You know, we've had boomlets before, not even boomlets, but booms in commercial construction. I think of the biggest one was in the late 80s here in Seattle when five high-rises were approved at the same time, including the Columbia Tower, which is our tallest one. And then many of them sat empty, went into foreclosure or a process called deed in lieu of foreclosure. And you see what's happening now. It's a little bit scary for those of us who watched it before.
People in the commercial real estate industry have told me that the commercial lending banks, not home loan banks, sort of swing in pendulums, like we're going to do office construction and everybody loans for that, or we're going to do condo loans, we're going to do hotel construction. So we see these kind of waves because it's sort of a bandwagon effect.
Yeah, I think what happens is they see vacancy rates very low in a particular market segment, and there's a rush to fill a need. So, you know, that's fundamental economics, capitalism, supply and demand. And it's fine in theory, but when everybody does it at the same time and they're not watching each other, that's when you can wind up with a glut. So that's the thing to watch out for.
Well, it'll be interesting to see also if we do see more individual houses go back on the market in the Puget Sound, central Puget Sound area, what that does to the prices of homes. Right now, values are going up. So if you already own a home, at least on paper, that's good for you.
Right.
Lastly, interesting report came out from the Economic Policy Institute this week that they surveyed a number of cities in the United States looking for what a family of various sizes needed to maintain what they call a modest lifestyle. And that's a lifestyle at 40% of median wages. And so in Seattle, according to the Economic Policy Institute, a family of four with two parents, two kids, needs a little over $70,000 a year just to maintain this modest lifestyle. And the amount that they put in for rent was less than what you pay for
$1,100 or
something. Yeah, and I don't even know that we have anything in Seattle that would house four people comfortably.
Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. I mean, that's my reaction too. You and I live in a different world than than a lot of people, sadly. You know, we're not rich, or at least I'm not. I don't know about you.
No.
But we're far better off than many, many, many people. So I guess, you know, the world of averages, it's you have to remember that it's taking into account a lot of things. But I was kind of shocked by the $1,100 figure, too, or whatever it was.
$70,000 a year is a lot of money. And we're not talking about the poverty level here, because this is significantly more than the poverty level figures, which are federal statistics. But it was a high, I mean, probably to some people not a high number, but it seemed like a relatively high number, $70,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Seattle is, you know, as it's not a big surprise to those of us who live here. It's one of the more expensive cities in the country. We had a story late last year, I think it was, that we're 17th out of the top 25 cities in home affordability, which is a measure of, you know, median home price against median income. So it's a tough place to live, to afford to live.
So we're having all these, we're citing, you know, market prices heating up, commercial construction up, Microsoft doing okay at this point, not a penny stock. Not, I know Boeing, there's a lot of construction still. The future is a little bit murkier.
They've been doing well, though.
Is the middle class keeping up with all these you know, rosy signs?
The upper middle class certainly is. The middle class, I think, is always feeling nervous and kind of teetering a little bit. You know, and I think the good news is we're coming off of the dark days of the, you know, quote unquote, Great Recession, and the high unemployment, relatively high unemployment numbers we had here. So that is all looking like good news. But you still hear, there's a real bitter undercurrent, I think, still about the haves and have-nots and what corporate CEOs are making compared to the rank and file workers in their very own companies, those kinds of issues. You know, every time I see one of those, it just reminds me that the middle class is still struggling, is still feeling cheated, and that they're slipping farther behind, and they're well off compared to a whole lot of other people. So,
interesting. Michelle Matassa-Flores is managing editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. She's been a frequent guest this summer on our show. Thanks for coming in again today.
Thank you.
Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Guy Nelson is at the helm today. I'm Marcy Silman. Hope you join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking with comedian Harry Kondabolu, and also Sub Pop's Jonathan Poneman joins us to talk about the long history of the indie record label that put Seattle on a lot of people's rock maps. That's coming up tomorrow on Weekday on KUOW.
KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Good morning, I'm Guy Nelson. It's 10:59. 59 degrees in Seattle with some morning clouds that are clearing slowly. We'll have mostly sunny skies this afternoon. High temperature 75. Coming up in a few minutes, To the Point.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. On the next To the Point, since the attacks of September 11th, a secret court has allowed the government to scoop up the phone and internet records of millions of Americans. What are the possibilities of abuse? Is the country any safer? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's 6 minutes from now on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. Doug Fine takes a look at the history of hemp and the current underground marijuana economy in his book, Too High to Fail, from Gotham. He discusses on Friday, July 12th at 7 p.m. at U Bookstore on the Ave. More information at ubookstore.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.